Hello, I'm Hugo Disler from Farming Secrets. We've got the pleasure to have online Martin Royds. He's from Braidwood in New South Wales. So, Martin, are you there?
I'm here, yes, from Chillamatong in Chilly Braidwood.
Chilly, all right. Now, Martin, you might give us a bit of a rundown of what you're doing up there.
Well, at the moment, we're on my farm. I do practice natural sequence farming, holistic management, and experiment with a lot of biological means of improving my farm. And basically, I'm wanting to work with the landscape and with biology rather than being in the cycle of putting lots of chemicals on and having to kill and fight the landscape. And it seems to be working.
Good.
This is good.
Good. Well, we'll talk about that as soon as we can. You've had quite a few people that you've been influenced by. You've been to quite a few courses. So what have you got out of those courses, or how did you start doing what you're doing? Physically started?
Well, my interests started many years ago when I looked at how to turn sand into productive vegetable farms and I experimented just rotting things down. I then went off to university, and then I found that most of the universities, unfortunately, were probably a little bit behind the game, and there were a lot of people out there that had ideas that could help improve the productivity and the environment and the economics of farming. And so I started with holistic management. I've been to talks with Alan Savory and done a course on holistic management in biodynamics, and we've actually held courses here on biodynamics at Chillamatong. And then I bumped into Peter Andrews at a property over the hill from here, and I've been involved with him for the last 7 or 8 years. And then I've also sought out Dr. Christine Jones, Martin Stapper, and people like that, and sucked as much information as I can from them and blended that to make something that works on a working farm.
So how did you actually start? What was the first step?
The biggest steps are probably in your mind, looking at, it was actually started by a friend of mine who asked me some questions, which was, how much does it cost to do the farming techniques that we were doing at the moment? And that was with set stocking, the cost of improving the pasture every 5 to 7 years. And that cost, he'd figured out, took 10 to 12 years to get our money back. And with set stocking was only lasting 5 to 7 years, so we were effectively going financially backwards. And so talking to the holistic managers, then you started learning about how the landscape repaired itself under big herds of animals and the rest and recovery processes. And when you start doing that, then you start looking more at your soil and pasture and realizing that the techniques that we were using with set stocking, we were chewing out all the desirable plants and ending up with weeds. And we could reverse that by time-controlled grazing. And then that gets you really, once you start looking at your pasture and soil and that, it gets you wanting to learn more and more. And so as you keep bumping into me, a lot of the courses you're at filming, I'm out there learning more and more all the time, Hugo.
Yep, no, we have bumped into each other. Now, not many farmers are doing what you're doing. So how would the farmer actually start? Where would he, is it a mindset? Yeah, just gives a bit of a clue. You started with a lot of input from a lot of experts. If a farmer hasn't had all these experts, how would he start?
I think the principal thing is to go and do a course on holistic management if you can. and there's quite a few educators around doing that, and it's probably the best way of starting, because we do get a lot of information thrown at us from chemical companies and fertilizer companies, and that they were always telling us farmers what's the best way of farming, but they've all got an interest there, and so we need to be able to make informed decisions. And the best way of decision making process that I've found has been, is the holistic management training. So that's, I think I'd recommend most people to go and do a course first and then start looking back at their farm and asking themselves the questions of where, what's their goal and where do they want to head, and are the processes that they're doing heading towards that or away from it. And then, as you know, depending on their individual farm, their situation, they can add on all the other people that I've bumped into. And I'm happy to give you a list, and most of them have got a website of where you can contact people to get individual information on, you know, biodynamics or natural sequence farming or whatever.
So Martin,
tailor their own farm to.
Sorry, what's that?
Oh, just depending on what people want to tailor their enterprise towards, I think, is the different people. But there's getting quite a network out there, and a lot of them you've got videos on, so probably yes. The second best process is to join your group, isn't it?
Yeah, well, get the confidence in within the options that the farmer's got. Now, to do that, everything's sort of driven by money these days. What's in it for the farmer if it comes to the money, or how quickly did you start recuperating the money, or how did you find that it was worthwhile investing into this sort of process?
Yes, well, I'm with a group called Source for Life, and there's 19 farmers that have been selected in that group. And nearly all of us got into it because we actually didn't have the money to keep farming the way we were doing. So most of the time you'll find that the farming practices that I use and that most of the people in the Source for Life program are using, they actually save you money and make money more in the long term as well. I mean, there's, I remember talking to one guy who'd been converted to biodynamics, and he did say that he went for 5 or so years where he said he had more dinner times came round than hot dinners turned up. So, you know, he'd done it tough for a couple of years. But most things, it's not so much a big cost. You just mightn't earn initially as much money as you were earning. But in the long term, the finances, I've found, are far better. I've done benchmarking with a lot of the local farmers around here, and I'm now far ahead of them in my earnings per hectare, earnings per 100 mils of rain, earnings per wage unit, etc. And we're finding now that we've got a lot more resilience in our landscape, so when a dry time comes, we've still got green grass. In fact, at the moment, if you drive over, well, actually, the best indicator now, Hugo, is the kangaroos. I went down to my back paddock the other day and I counted 200 kangaroos that hopped in, and I've never seen so many. So all the neighbouring farms around here are obviously running out of grass, and the kangaroos are telling me where the good stuff is. And you can see it, actually, when you drive over the hill. Our paddocks are looking a bit greener, even though we've got more cattle per hectare than our neighbours. So whatever we're doing, it must be improving the resilience of the farm.
How long would a farmer start? You mentioned 2 to 5 years for one particular farmer. How long
I'm probably a slow learner. It took me 5 to 7 years till we really started getting a big change, and a lot of that was because I actually took my time to actually go and do the course. I thought I knew what I was doing and went out there and just got little snippets and started experimenting, and luckily could notice after a couple of years that I was actually going backwards, and that's with my controlled grazing. I didn't fully understand the science behind it all, and so I was going backwards. But as I told you the last time you were down here, I've seen people who've gone out and turned a farm around in 2 or 3 years dramatically by going and doing the courses properly and getting out there and doing it. And I've done it on degraded farms I've bought now. I can see that within 3 years you can turn them around dramatically, going from, you know, when the soil is hard as a rock and very little biodiversity to lusher pastures and worms in the soil. But that 2 or 3 years, you're not making much money off the farm, so that's the challenge.
Well, that is the key thing for a farmer to change, that most farmers got some sort of formula to survive or keep going, and how do they act? Yeah, I'm just sort of trying to work.
That was a really degraded farm that I took over, and it had no fences. It was hard as a rock, and it was in a drought. So, yes, it took a couple of years till we started to make a profit. I did have an opportunity in the middle of that we had some native grasses that took off when we had a big storm, and we were able to harvest the seed off that and made some income. So my operation, I tend to be fairly flexible and looking for opportunities. And the native grasses, I think, is going to take off in the next, in the last 2 months, I've had 5 phone calls with people wanting native grass seed. So I think that's an area that's going to be improved dramatically. And I'm finding right now that cattle prices are still not that good. So I'm finding you need to be more flexible in your incomes anyway.
Mm.
Because most farmers I talk to are finding, you know, the prices we're getting for our beef are not where they really need to be. So it doesn't matter whether you're a chemical farmer or a biological farmer, you're still going to be challenged. But the advantage I've got is that my inputs are very low. It's more time and management. And most of the biological fertilizers I make my own. So the costs are very low. And if you can just live frugally for a couple of years, you can then suddenly find you're in a position where you're actually making more money than the chemical farmers.
Yeah.
Most chemical farmers I know, they're on that treadmill. They're running there and they're saying, help me get off this, because my bank's saying you've got to keep producing more and more and more. And they're putting more and more on, and they're ending up in that situation where the moron effect, they actually end up turning their soils into rock and ending up with more and more weeds.
And you end up farming with needing sort of a steady flow of finance. As I was talking to one farmer, he said that in the last so many years, I think it's 10 or so years, that in most years all he could do is pay the interest and had nothing extra.
Yep. Sadly, we're all getting that situation, and it's interesting to see this political environment at the moment. There's so many of them are actually mentioning the fact that we've got this duopoly controlling most of our agricultural produce. You know, that Coles and Woolworths are, their principal goal is to look after their shareholders, and they to do the best for their shareholders, they've got to buy the product cheap as they can, and so it's not in their best interest to look after the farmer by any means, and we're all getting squeezed. And I've talked to a lot of vegetable farmers of late who are really, really struggling to keep producing, and some of them are producing, you know, semi-trailer loads of broccoli, and yet they're ending up not making a profit because we've got this duopoly and they can set the price that they get paid. So it's interesting. I think, you know, in a political situation right now. We need to be helping our politicians look at that duopoly, and it does seem to be mentioned a lot at the moment.
Yeah, right. With your infrastructures that you put in, your infrastructures are quite... Now, before we get on to the infrastructures, if a farmer wants to start, would he need an expert to come on the property or to you know, help him set up where various swales to go and where the various plugs to go and that sort of thing?
Probably yes. yeah, actually, with the swales and those sort of things, where to site them is quite an art. I'm getting better, and I've spent 5 to 7 years in close proximity to Peter Andrews. So there is a course that Stuart Andrews is running on Tarnwin Park, and I'd highly recommend that to people if they wanted to learn about where to stop erosion and put water out onto their landscape and get nutrient cycling and that sort of thing in the natural sequence farming ideas.
So how do people access or get to know the Stuart Andrews person?
They've got a website.
Is it
Natural Sequence Farming?
Farming
website and look at, I know Dwayne Norris, I should have. I'll see if I can get the numbers and we can put it on your website for that. I was flicking through websites the other day and I came upon it a couple of times. So most people, if you've got an email, internet connection, should be able to find Natural Sequence Farming training programs, Tarnwin Park. I think, yeah, I'd just go Tarnwin Park training.
I think we have got on our website there somewhere.
Yep, good.
Now
with the biological products, now most of that people can do on their farm very cheaply, very easily. And I've set up my own worm farm, just an old bath. I was looking at Bruce Davidson's used old car bodies and things like that and set up his worm farm. But, worm farms are very easy to set up and you can get the worms quite easily. People contact me, I can post them off a kilo of worms. And then you can start making your own worm juice, and I spray that out with a very simple process. I know this Bruce bought a special thing, but I use just a firefighting pump and a couple of nozzles, big nozzles, 1 or 2 millimeter nozzles, and that spray out a fan jet and in an old trailer, and that seems to work very well.
With can you use that same equipment for your biodynamic liquids?
Definitely, yep. I do, and I've talked to Andrew about that, and yes, it mightn't be the ideal, but if 90% of the products out there and working, I think, a simple, cheap system that you can make out of what most people got on a farm anyway, a firefighting unit and a 1,000-litre tank. I've got flow forms for mixing my products, which can cost a couple of $1,000s, but it might add 10 or 20% in effectiveness of the product, but I know Bruce, for instance, doesn't use flow forms to mix up his worm juice. He just puts it straight into a tank. But I think the biodynamic people, if you get right into their, some of them, they've got those stainless steel mixers and all those sort of things that can cost you a lot of money.
They
might be a little bit more effective, but for starters, you can do it in a bucket.
And are their capacity of those limited to the size unit you've bought? But
yeah,
we won't go down that track. Now, getting on to that question I partially asked was, how long would it take to, or how long did it take you to get your money back on the capital expenditure that you've put on, into the place? Or what's the estimate to get the money back?
Yeah, that's a good point. For the biological sprays and that, you can set up a process for a couple of $1,000s. And I used to spend $10,000 to $20,000 a year spreading artificial fertilizers and all sorts of other things. And so now I'd be lucky to spend $2,000 a year. I buy a few little additives like some seaweed meal, some fish hydrolysate, and products like that that, you know, I don't make myself. But all the worm juice and all that, that it's just time. I collect waste products from the cafes in town and a bit of cow dung, a bit of bath salt crusher dust and things like that, and the worms do all the work for me. And I've found that you can store the worm juice in those egg-shaped 200-litre tanks for months without it going off. So the cost of making it, it's very little. And the spraying out, most people should have a firefighting unit and, you know, a couple of $100 worth of poly fittings and nozzles, and you're up and running. So to get your money back, I'd say in a year.
And what about the earthworks, getting money back on the swale?
To do all the erosion works on my place, and I had a kilometre and a half big erosion gully up the property, it cost me $14,000 to put in, I think it was about 12 different banks and that along the whole erosion gully. Well, that, in the past, that was my yearly fertiliser bill. So it's 1 year's fertiliser bill, and to get your money back, I'd say probably 2 or 3 years. Actually, we haven't had rain in the last 2 months, so it's starting to dry out here, and I've now got my contour channels pumping water out into the landscape, so when it does warm up a bit, it'll grow away far, far quicker than my neighbours.
So in actual fact, the return on your investment is pretty quick on what, like you say, $14,000
yep.
versus spending $10,000 to $20,000 on artificial fertilisers. Now that leads
yep.
on to the next question. Is there did you or would you suggest people to wean themselves off artificial fertilisers or from one process to the other process?
Probably best, yes. What I'd think is if once you start adding the biological products, the effectiveness of your artificial fertilisers dramatically increases. So if you said, right, oh, I'm normally spending $10,000 a year on superphosphate, let's drop it to $5,000 the first year and put $2,000 into spraying worm juice and seaweed and fish, and do a little patch and see if you can see the difference. And the best way to test if you're having an effect is to do half a paddock and then put your cattle into that paddock and see which side they go and eat first. And they'll soon tell you which is the sweetest and which has got the most nutrition in it. And I did the experiment myself, and I actually moved the cattle out of a paddock I'd sprayed into a paddock I hadn't, and they broke the fence down to come back into the one I'd sprayed. So they definitely told me which one was their preferred.
But what about
and
the production in the paddocks which have sprayed when you're in this transition stage?
Yeah, see, sometimes you can look, like if you spray nitrogen fertilizer onto grass, it races up and looks dark green and luscious. But the cattle actually don't like eating it as much as if you've sprayed worm juice and those sort of things on it. And what I've noticed is the cattle don't need to eat as much. And so I've noticed they're sitting down at 9 o'clock in the morning chewing their cud. So we can get hoodwinked into thinking volume is good, but what I've noticed is that quality is better and the cows don't need to eat as much. And the proof in the pudding is that I'm running up to double the stocking rate of my neighbours that are still using it. Or they spread, actually they haven't been able to, but they used to spread super every 2 to 3 years. they haven't for the last 5 years because they're not making enough money on their farm. But there's a dramatic difference now on mine where the grasses seem to be greener and the cattle don't seem to eat as much.
Now, your property is gently undulating. Now,
yep.
if the property was flat, fairly flat, any advice you would give farmers? What would they do on a flat property?
It's probably easier for them to put the contour channels in. So, as you'd seen here, I've put contour channels from my weirs that I put in the erosion gully, and I can direct water out onto those now and hydrate the landscape. And along those contour channels, we've got compost heaps, so that's self-fertilizing the water as the water trickles down the contour channel. And if I had flatter country, I'd probably put more of those across the country. It's actually more difficult to put them across our fairly undulating country. We rise probably 50 to 70 metres out of the valley up to the tops of the hills, so it's quite a jump, and there's a lot of granite rock there, which makes it tricky to put the contour channels in. Now, going back to your question, Hugo, about costs, my contour channels with a big grader cost $800. That was 6 years ago, but now with increased fuel prices, it probably cost $1,200 to put 3.5 kilometres of channel in. And that now I can pump water along those and hydrate the bottom 10 to 20% of my farm. So for $800 or $1,200 in today's dollars, it's not a big cost. And if you can then put your compost heaps in it and be fertilising at the same time, it's
sounds
a process
like
that once you've done that, I've got no cost except going along and just, you know, with a shovel, cleaning them out and fixing them up, doing, as Peter Andrews calls it, you know, the gardening maintenance.
Yeah, so it actually is very cost efficient, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah. No, I've got those other compost heaps that I've set up around the farm too, and I mean, I just keep amazing myself with how well the grass grows in them. You know, even now, when we haven't had rain for a couple of months, they're looking green and lush as it starts to warm up, and they're pumping fertility into the landscape all over the place. And those were just designed to sit on lumps in the landscape, and we've directed water off the council roads and off little gullies into them, so then they pick up fertility and spread that down through the property. Now, I think on flatter country it's a lot easier to do that. You can have a lot of fun running around with putting contour channels in. And the secret is that they are right on the contour and dead on flat, rather than before we used to do things that we called contour channels but were actually contour drains.
Yeah. Well, I think you explained that in your DVDs quite well, that you don't have that fall unless you actually wanted to go into that particular dam that you had.
Yeah.
And would you still have a fall on it now that you know
I
what
wouldn't
you're doing?
Now? No, no. I
wouldn't have
a fall
on it.
Yeah. As Peter explained, if you've got a half metre deep contour channel, then you've got half a metre to push along. The water can push along that channel to a depth of half a metre. So if you've got water at one end, it'll run all along that channel before it starts overflowing. It's got
so
to be
the idea
half a metre deep before it rises over, or some of mine up to a metre deep before they rise up and over the dead level contour bank. A little storm or rain will fill that all up, and then it'll seep into the soil better.
So the message is to have your contour channels or swales. What do you call them? What do you call them?
Both. Yeah.
Okay.
Either, but yeah, the top of the swale or the channel bank's got to be flat.
You have them flat. Yeah.
Yep.
So we've got to get that right.
And it does mean you've got to go, when it rains a bit, you've got to run along with a shovel, because if it starts breaking out anywhere, it'll soon chew down. And once you get them all flat and they grass up, then you've got, it'll self-repair itself, because if you've got, like I throw in those channels rotting vegetation and things like that, and so if, once it fills up, it'll, vegetation will float to surface, and when it starts to break over the bank, it'll repair itself by dropping that floating material. And that's what used to happen naturally in the landscape. You know, when it flooded out, it'd push material out and it'd get caught on grass and reeds and hold, and then push the water further out into the landscape. That's what I've learned from Peter Andrews.
Once a farmer had someone like Peter Andrews on his property, would it be advisable to have him come out again at other times?
Well, I learn from Peter every time I talk to him, yes. The first time he talks to you, it sounds like double Dutch, actually, and you need to read his book probably first, so you understand what he's talking about. But I think if you'd read his book and can go to a field day, and then I'd get him, pay him to come out and talk about how to design things in your landscape. But if you got him just straight out without doing some homework, I think you'd find it a little bit frustrating, because you wouldn't probably get as much out of it as you could.
Yeah, and you would say it is worthwhile for the farmer to go down the track that you've gone down.
I definitely, yes, because you get to the stage you're feeling much more in control of the situation. You're seeing your landscape repair and build, and it's so much more rewarding, because nearly every farmer wants to leave his land in a better state, but a lot of us were feeling with that could see our landscape was going backwards. You know, droughts and drier periods were seeing our topsoil blow away or wash away. Now what I've instigated, no matter what happens, you know, we get a flash flood and it, instead of the water rushing down the erosion gullies, it's pushing fertility back out onto the old floodplains. And so I'm seeing the landscape build, and also through the holistic management training, when we get into a drier times, we maintain a ground cover and sell our stock off rather than we used to hold them and chew the grass all off and then see it blow away. But now I feel that most of the people that I meet who've done holistic management feel a lot more in control and feel they're improving their property biologically and environmentally a lot quicker than they used to, which makes you feel better.
And when you talk about repairing your property and sort of charging with water, does it make it more fertile? As you said earlier in this conversation, you do carry more stock. So you're actually increasing the fertility of the property without buying fertilizer.
Correct. And that is possible. And, nearly everybody in say, the Soils for Life program are finding that they're building soil carbon, building biodiversity, building resilience in their property by slowing the water down, recycling the nutrients. We've all heard the science that most of the superphosphate we used to spread used to get locked up in the soil within a few months, and that's still there. We just need to unlock it, and biology is the secret of doing that. And for biology to work, we need water back in the system. So if we can slow the water down and get it cycling in our properties, we can start releasing the locked up phosphates, which then make the grass grow better, and we're on a positive cycle rather than a negative cycle that we're all finding ourselves.
Now, you explained that at one stage you explained that you changed your fences so they went sort of up and down the hill, and that was to do with the fertility up the top of the hill and taking the fertility up there. Two questions. One, explain the principle behind that, and the second one is is it, how long does it take to recover the cost of changing your fencing?
I haven't done a costing, but I definitely, it was funny, just today I was out in one of those paddocks where I did have the fences going across the paddock, up the slope, and I was putting the stock in the lower paddock and then in the middle part of the paddock and then on the top of the hills. And that paddock, I've now swapped it around so the cattle can go down to the bottom and walk up the top of the hill. And I just noticed today on a cold day, there's a huge amount of cow dung up on top of the hill where they camped last night. And then during the day, as it got warmer, they walked down the slope and down into the cold, frosty valleys, and they were all down there eating at lunchtime today. And then going back up the top of the hill to camp at night where it's 5 to 7 degrees warmer than the Frost Hollow. And
that's
now the cost of fencing, I use electric fencing there, probably about $400 a kilometre now, so it's half a kilometre each fencing up this paddock. So, you know, say $1,000, and instead of the fertility being down, well, the cattle are transporting all the fertility up the top of the hill every night now. I don't know, I could figure it out. I've got 100 cows in the paddock and they're transporting, 8 to 10 kilos a day up the hill. So it's quite a little expense for the benefit that they're doing now.
Well, Pete Andrews makes quite a point of transferring the nutrient up the hills and having your plantations up in the hills. And he also makes a point, once farmers have removed their trees from the hills start going backwards at a great rate. Now, what's happening on your property?
So we've now, instead of planting trees in the erosion gullies down the bottom, we're now planting trees on top of the hill. And so in winter, as I just explained, happening, and likewise in summer the same happens because the cows want to go up to the shade of the trees on the top of the hill. So we're planning now that we're trying to encourage the cattle to drink and eat down on the bottom and then come up and ruminate on the tops of the hills, and normally when they stand up after ruminating they defecate, and so they're carting the fertility up the hill for us summer and winter. And I should take a photograph. Actually, I will tomorrow go out and take a photograph and send it to you. The amount that they carry up is phenomenal. And I was noticing right now in the middle of winter, we don't have any dung beetles processing all that cow dung up the top, but I'm going to take some worms out of my worm farm and go and scatter them around the dung pats and see if they start chewing that up.
They will. David Davidson, our other worm man, he has done that, and he actually collects them later on by putting boxes of dung in that area, and they come back into those boxes, and he gives them a good home.
All right, moves them around, exactly.
So actually, recollects them.
Yep. Well, I've noticed that happen with my worm farms. If I go away and forget to feed them and water them for a while, they abandon ship. And you'll find them, you walk around near the worm farm, any cow that's dropped a dung there will be full of worms. So, and then you can encourage them back by feeding your worm farm back up again. They must come to the surface and sniff the air or something, because they crawl back into their bathtubs.
It's amazing, Alan. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
We will open the line, so any farmer who wants to talk, ask a question, we would like you to, and just because we're talking, just feel free to butt in and start asking your question. And we just like to hear what you've got to say. Or what any questions you want to ask. So anyone who's online, feel free to just ask a question. the other thing too, when I'm reading back from the Beyond the Brink, and Peter talks constantly about having your paddock green with weeds and everything else. So how would you describe that to the other farmers? Because farmers are trained to get rid of all their weeds, and here he is to say, no matter what grows, you just let it grow to have that green carpet. Can you sort of explain that?
Definitely, Hugo, a paradigm shift to just thinking. I used to spray out sorrel, volpia, and thistles, and all those sort of weeds, and now I realise that most of those weeds are either there because, well, they're nearly always there because I've overgrazed or overcompacted or degraded the paddock. And so, one, they're more an indicator. So I always look at the weeds as an indicator that there's something wrong in the paddock, and that's why they're there. And then the other factor is that if you watch stock, a lot of the time when you put them into a paddock, they go and eat what we used to spray out. So most of those weeds that we thought were no good, the stock are saying, actually, we like them in preference to the phalaris and ryegrass and all those other introduced grasses that we used to put in the paddock. And the best example of that is you see people have got a crop of oats or something, and they put their sheep, fat lambs or cattle in there to graze them, and you go back the next day and you'll find that the boundary of that crop is chewed to the boards before the stock have actually gone in to start eating the lush-looking oats. And so they've eaten all the weeds growing on the edge of the paddock first. And when you start noticing this, you realise, well, hang on, maybe those grasses or weeds are good for the stock anyway. And so when you stop worrying about them, they're not a problem anymore, and then you realise that they actually disappear. And most of my property, I've got hardly any thistles left now because I'm grazing the paddocks well, and they're not needing to grow up to repair the landscape.
Martin, I want to just interrupt there. I just want to talk to our listeners. We're getting a little bit of noise from our listeners coming in, so I have to sort of mute the listeners. So if you want to ask a question, which we'd love you to, press star 2, and we'll see that you're coming on the screen, and we'll unmute, and you can ask questions. So we'd really like you to ask questions. Back to you, Martin. I don't know what we're talking about, but
the weeds on the farm and whether I should worry about them. And so basically now, and Peter's saying, you know, basically if you've got a plant that's green and growing, then let it grow, because they're nearly always doing some benefit to your farm. And I've got a classic example where we had a dozer here one day, and it turned out a thistle. And the root of that thistle went down nearly 2 metres into my paddock. And I cannot pull a plough through or an agro plough or anything like that down to 2 metres. So this thistle was aerating and opening up my soil to that depth. And if you think of it that way, you realise that they can do a lot of good for your soil in repairing it, opening it up, letting, you know, once that thistle dies in the 6 months' time, it's left this big hole that if I had a storm of rain, the water will soak into the soil very quickly. And also, I noticed that cattle actually eat thistles. You know, I used to think that they were not doing anything there, but if you watch the thistles, the stock actually eat them.
I've heard sheep farmers say that their sheep do actually eat them too.
Mm. I mean, we've all seen horses eat the thistle heads off, green thistles, but when a thistle dies down, if you put cattle into a paddock and get out early in the morning when the dew's on it and they're soft, the stock will eat the dead thistle leaves and all that. They're just normally not out there at 5, 6 o'clock in the morning when the dew's on them.
Yeah. Peter Andrews also did say in his book, Beyond the Brink, is that he grew a crop of wheat, or grew for several years, in a paddock which had massive amounts of weeds. He stripped the wheat, and he reckons he had fertility there, and the fertility just kept on increasing without any fertilizer. Have you had any experience in something like that, or know farmers?
I've done little experiments. Well, not, it wasn't a planned experiment. I used to be a chemical farmer. I used to do contract spraying, and I had some chemical left in the shed in about, oh, I think it was about 2007 or 8, when we'd had a dry time and I'd overgrazed a few paddocks, and I wanted to drill some seed in there to get them back into production again. And I sprayed some of this chemical out, and I only had enough to do one paddock, and I sowed three paddocks. Well, the paddock that I sprayed, yes, I killed all the weeds that had come up, and we ended up with lovely green lines of the pastures that I'd sown. The paddocks that I didn't spray looked all messy. They had weeds all over them, and you could hardly see the grasses that I'd sown. But the next year, the paddock that I'd sprayed came back to the weeds again, and you lost a lot of the pasture with it underneath the weeds. The paddocks that I hadn't sprayed came back with better and better pasture, and it took nearly 3 years till the weeds went out of the paddock I'd sprayed, whereas the paddock that I hadn't sprayed, within a year, was thick and beautiful pasture and very little weeds at all. So I've done that experiment and proved to myself, yep, there's no doubt about it. If you want to perpetuate weeds, spray chemical on them. Spray weedicides promotes weeds.
I was talking to a seed dressing person up at Ningen, who's one of our Farming Circus members, and he said it would be possible for a farmer to grow a cereal crop with weeds, and it would be economical to sift out the weeds with, but he said some weeds could be a bit of a problem, so it can be done, or could be done.
It's more, most of it comes down to what we visually think of the landscape, and we love to see this lovely, perfect crop, be it oats or wheat or even, you know, that's all the one colour and the one height and all that, and that's what we think's good. And of course, we're told by the people selling the weedicides and all that that's what a good farmer's like. And if you go past a paddock and you can see all sorts of things growing up through the crop, we think it looks messy. But the big change I've had to do is I actually want plants in all different stages of growing and senescence and flowering and seeding and all that sort of stuff at all the times in my pasture, because I know that's the healthiest, that's the natural system, should have some plants that are growing, some plants that are dying, and some that are ready to be eaten at all times. Whereas, you know, when I was a chemical farmer, I used to spray everything and I didn't feel good unless I'd killed every single thing in the paddock. And then I'd go out and sow a new pasture in them, and it'd all come up looking nice and even. And we were taught that was a good farmer. But I now go past a paddock where somebody's killed everything, and I shudder, because I know they've literally killed everything, and nothing's going to grow there for a while. Whereas I've always got something growing in my paddock, and I've seen croppers like Col Sice has always got something growing in his paddock. And yes, it mightn't look as neat and tidy, but he's stripping just as much wheat off his paddock. He might have to clean a few other seeds out of it, but the day he finishes stripping his paddock, he can put his stock in there and there's green feed underneath, and he's producing 365 days of the year out of his paddock. Whereas when you kill it, you've got nearly 3 months of the year where there's dead paddock, and so the soil life starts dying because there's nothing there alive to keep feeding the soil life.
And Peter Andrews explained. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
Peter Andrews explains in his book Beyond the Brink that how detrimental it is as far as losing carbon, which is your soil fertility, in those
yep.
months that you're trying to keep your soil clean, whether it's by ploughing or by spraying or whatever.
Yep. Yep. And you talk to Elaine Ingham or Christine Jones, and they say it's critical to have your soil life being fed all the time. And that can only happen if you've got a plant growing there. And so, you know, if you're a cropper, you need to have a plant growing there all year round to keep your soil life alive. And so then even if you are putting in artificial fertilizers, they can be activated and working if you've got soil biology there. If not, you're a hydroponic farmer.
You know, Pete Andrews
and
keeps talking
accept
about
that. You might have to clean your seeds. But most harvesters can pull out all your weed seeds.
It's up to farmers to
bird seed that you can sell.
It's up to farmers to experiment on a certain size section of their farm, which they're comfortable experimenting with.
Yeah. And do it for 2 or 3 years, and you'll soon find that you've got a process happening that can improve your soil, improve your pasture, and or improve your crop. And you might find that those other weed seeds that you're harvesting have got a value that you can cash in on as well.
Yeah.
But you only have to look at Cole Sice. You know, he's getting huge carbon build up in his soil as from his technique of pasture cropping,
which is fertility, isn't it?
Crop into pasture.
Yeah, which is a proof of fertility increasing, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, Hugo, you said somebody before had a question about how to stop a dam leaking.
Yes, I did bring up Ron Smith, and Ron Smith said that he has used a product in quite a large dam. I think it was 3 megs or so. And he used a product called Aquatech, and he didn't know where it came from, but it was sort of a granular type of product, and it worked exceptionally well. But anyway, have you got an answer for that?
Well, the other products that are traditionally used is bentonite, which is a clay type product that will sink down and block up your holes, and that's I've used it where we've spread bentonite at the final stages. You know, if we're working in a granite type porous soil, you spread the bentonite in the final processes, and then try and incorporate it into the top 10 or 20 centimetres of your dam. But I've also, when I've built a dam and it's slowly leaking, gone and spread bentonite out over the top. And my grandfather years ago used to spread bran, as in Polydon bran, out on a leaking dam, and it sank down and eventually stopped the dam leaking. And that's what I was saying the other day. You know, biology will normally eventually stop a dam leaking. And the best examples of that, if you go into the Fraser Island, which is all a sand dune, and there's all these perched lakes, and it's leaf litter and that sort of biology that has stopped the water seeping out of the sand. So
these lakes are above sea level, are they?
Yeah. Sitting quite high above sea level, and it's just all the leaf litter and biology that has made these...
And they're on sand.
Lakes, and just absolute sand dunes, yeah.
Just goes to show what nature can do.
Yes, bit of biology. Just trust nature.
Trust nature. Now, I've got a question here, which to do with improved pasture versus native grass. I take it you're sort of for native grasses. Now, how would you compare the value of improved improved pastures to that of the native grasses?
I used to spray out a lot of our native pasture and so improved grasses. Then when we found in the drought, the only thing that survived was a lot of the native grasses. So now I blend the two. So if I've got a native pasture that I'm thinking there's sort of periods where it's not productive and we've got a lot of kangaroo grass which dies off in winter. So I've direct drilled into the kangaroo grass, fescues and phalaris and ryegrass and that'll grow in the autumn, winter, spring period when the kangaroo grass is not very active, and then the kangaroo grass gets away. And there's quite a productive grass in the summer periods.
So the grass you put in is fescue, phalaris,
and ryegrass. And actually, I actually drilled some lucerne into it as well, which has taken.
How successful has that been?
Oh, it's been very successful. It's quite a productive paddock now, and Microlina is my favourite native grass, and that's because it grows all year. It slows down in winter, obviously, but it still grows a little bit in winter. But the best thing is that in the middle of summer, and if you get a shower of rain, it'll take off, whereas a lot of your introduced grasses are from the more Mediterranean climate and don't like a hot, dry summer. So the phalaris and fescues and that stop growing in the middle of summer, and whereas my microlina will take off. And that's why I drilled a bit of lucerne in as well. It'll grow away in the middle of summer as well.
And the microlina, how do a farmer get microlina?
It's best to try and encourage it because it's a very expensive seed to purchase. Most of the time, if you rest your paddocks and look out and learn how to identify your grasses, you'll find a lot of the native grasses are there, even paddocks that we'd ploughed and sown down native pastures for a couple of times, introduced grasses, there was still a little bit of native grass there, and I now identify it, wait till it goes to seed and rest the paddock when it's going to seed and let it do its cycle, and then put the stock back in again to encourage germination of new microlina and that. And I've had paddocks where I ended up really thick fescues and phalaris, and they were actually choking out all the other grasses. And so now I eat them down hard and wait till there's a summer storm, which a lot of the native grasses, Danthonia and microlina, will germinate and get away, and let them get away and try and get a little bit more competition in amongst the introduced grasses. So my goal always, Hugo, is to try and get as much biodiversity as I can in a paddock now. Well, I found that I was sowing two or three introduced grasses and ending up, with two or three introduced grasses, a couple of weeds and a couple of native grasses. If they're lucky, we're now finding that we're getting up to 80 different grasses, forbs and weeds across a transect in a paddock. And that's best for stock, best for the paddock.
And you don't mind the weeds?
No.
Right.
Once you start to learn how to use your stock to improve your pasture, you can then, in that process, you learn the vulnerability of your grasses. And, for instance, Vulpia, which is an annual weed that we had a problem with, I find out when it's vulnerable, which is when it's going up to seed, and I'll heavily graze the paddock then and end up taking that grass or weed out of the paddock or reducing its numbers. And likewise, I look at a paddock and say, okay, what do I need to or want to try and improve in this paddock? And it might be a native grass, it might be even an introduced grass. And I'll rest it when it's going to seed or wants to go to seed and let it go to seed and then heavily graze it again and virtually plough the seed back into that paddock and encourage germination of the desired species.
Martin, we want to keep these calls to about 1 hour. That's what suits us. So we're running out of time, and we want to wind up. So what is your message to farmers as far as your style of what's some of the messages that you'd like to relay to farmers?
I think to start observing nature, observing more of your paddocks. I know some of the people that I've worked with, the things that we've gained the most joy from are, you know, learning to identify all the plants in your paddock, and then going out and seeing how you can manipulate them using your stock and starting to change the biodiversity and the structure of the pasture in your paddock using your stock rather than using chemicals or ploughs and those capital-intensive programs that we used to do, because we're all getting squeezed with the cost of production, and when you start using processes that actually end up costing less money and give you more joy, you can actually make a greater profit at the end of it. And that's likewise with the biological fertilizers that we're using. It's experimenting with how to make your own fertilizer and processes that can put them out and make a healthy soil and a healthy pasture and therefore healthier cattle. And so we're using less drenches and no weedicides or any of those chemicals that we used to use.
But what you said, you're getting more satisfaction in farming.
That's it, yes. And it looks better and you start feeling better. Likewise with planting trees, you know, we find that it's encouraging birds. It's things, funny little things you don't think will happen, like the slowing the water down in the erosion gullies, as we've now got yabbies and that down in the water. The birds come and eat the yabbies, and they fly up the top of the hill and are taking fertility up the hill. And so what used to wash out of the bottom of our property is now getting carried to the top of the hill using nature.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see these processes starting to happen, it's a multiplier effect environmentally, and you feel better yourself because you're seeing nature starting to work with you rather than you constantly feeling you're fighting the latest weed, the latest bug that's attacking your pasture. And we're finding now we don't get the bugs, we don't get the weeds, and everything's working with us rather than against us.
Fantastic. Martin, we will wind up, and I just want to thank you very, very much for coming online, and also thank the farmers who are online, and thank for the farmers who are going to be listening to this CD. I think what you're doing and the sort of the education that you've collected together and proven that it works, you're just an absolute inspiration to other farmers to follow what you've done.
Thanks, Hugo, and I'd like to thank you and Helen for the programs that you're doing, because I know other farmers that listen to your programs and have been gaining a lot. And in the process of you quizzing me, it makes me question what I'm doing, and hopefully I learn from it too, and look forward to getting more questions from your listeners.
Fantastic. All right, Martin, well, I'll just say goodbye, and we'll talk another time.
Great, and happy spring to everybody.
Thank you very much, Martin.
Good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.